uyakwazi ukuthumela ama-email now.
We translate for those who can't understand. We write for those who can't hear. We describe for those who can't see. Subti, subtitles and accessibility for film, television and theater. Subti.com.
Fred.
Benvenuti su Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
This is Fred Film Radio, I am Eddie Bertotti.
Clémence Ferry-Latour for Fred Film Radio, en direct du Festival de Cannes.
簡単にその先生の作品のあの紹介を...
Alan Beconfi, Fred Film Radio, Marco Mamaragon.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Cinephile, you're listening to the Big Fred Tuesday, Fred Film Radio's weekly show on all things cinema, with a particular focus on independent filmmaking and the international film festival scene. The show is hosted and produced by me, Matt Micucci, the ringleader of The Tormented. And on this show, we're going to be taking a trip to the wonderful city of Berlin, the capital city of Germany and the heart and soul of the European continent. Why? Well, because this past week was the week of the short but dense and intense 2021 online edition of the Berlin International Film Festival. Throughout the show, we will be speaking with the directorial duo of Bardia Yadegari and Ehsan Mirhosseini, who also wrote and starred in District Terminal, an interesting film from Iran about the growing frustrations of a failing and drug-addicted poet. Not the typical film that we see coming out of Iran and making the festival run. That one was presented in the Encounter section. From there, we will be moving to Israel to talk about Adas Ben-Haroya's second directorial effort, All Eyes Off Me, a new film exploring sexual fantasies, intimacy and love in the modern world, and doing so in a fresh and original way. And finally, a rare one for the Big Fred Tuesday, because we will be heading to Brazil to chat with filmmaker Gustavo Pizzi about his miniseries, The Last Days of Gilda, about an independent and free woman living on the edge of the favelas and the growing hostilities that arise between her and a group of Christian reactionaries who are taking over the territory she calls home. There will be more Berlinale goodness, the conclusive popcorn classic segment, and more. But first, I can't ignore the fact that last week we also found out about this year's Golden Globe winners. A bit of a controversial one at that, but it wouldn't be right to skip over it altogether. Nomadland by Chloe Zhao, the winner of the latest Venice International Film Festival, received top honours in the drama section, was declared best film winner in that category, and Borat's subsequent movie film received top honours as best film in the musical or comedy section. It kind of goes to show that, you know, the last year wasn't exactly top class as far as films was concerned, at least if we're looking at the winners of the Golden Globes. Don't forget, there's better ways to find out what films are good or not. Minari picked up the award for Best Foreign Language Film, and I feel I should mention that it's a Korean language American production. For all other winners, check out the Google machine. I'd rather just carry on with our exclusive original content because we've got a lot to get to on this show. So without further ado, fire up an audio teeny, sit back, relax, and listen to the audio waves as they fly through the air.
Fred.
Joining us at this time on the Big Fred Tuesday are filmmakers Ehsan Mirhosseini and Bardia Yadegari, whose film District Terminal is presented at the 2021 Berlinale. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
How long have you guys known each other and when did your collaboration begin?
We have known each other about 10 years. So 10 years ago, we had a movie it was very successful around the world. Its name was Parviz, directed by Mr. Majid Barzegar. So Bardia was a screenwriter of that movie. So I liked that movie very much. So in that moment, I was trying to writing screenplays and trying to make them. So I contacted Bardia and our friendship had started 10 years ago. And we have been writing many screenplays and tried to make two screenplays. But because of the difficult production of them, we couldn't make the movie earlier. But about 4 years ago, we decided that make a very low-budget movie with each other so we can use all our energy and
budget
and our location, because the main location of the film is Bardia's home, and we use our friends and our families to make this movie, this very independent and low budget movie, District Terminal.
And friendship is a solution for us, for support each other, standing this fucking life.
All right. And do you also have common interests? Because I noticed, for example, in the film, which we will be talking about later, of course, you mentioned that you talk a lot about, philosophy, poetry, music. Do you find common ground there in your similar interests?
Yes, yes. We had many things in common, such as the philosophy you mentioned, and especially the psychoanalysis, especially Sigmund Freud and Jacques Lacan. And the literature, Bardia is himself a poet. He's a very good poet. And in the movie, we used Bardia's poems, and there is Bardia has a long poem that he's been trying to publish it, but he couldn't do that because of the censorship. And especially the history of cinema. Cinema is our main fetish. And so we had a fetishes relationship with the history of cinema, and we try to bring these interests in our movies, our screenplays, and our movie that made together, District Terminal, as you mentioned. Yeah, we have a lot of things in common. And
exactly. And if we can talk about District Terminal, the film, as you mentioned, is about this protagonist who is a poet, played by Bardia, and he's also a drug addict. He's also looking to get to America. He is in this sort of a strange relationship, and all sorts of things happening. Is there anything else that you'd like to say about the story for the listeners who are not familiar with it yet?
Yes, because of the very low budget that we had in this movie, we brought our reality. There are a lot of maybe the story is has a sci-fi element, but the base of the movie is our real life. Bardia played himself as a poet in the movie. Bardia's mother played the role of the mother, and my brother and our friends, almost they played the real roles in the movie. Yeah, and
I want to talk about a poem. We are all poets. Poetry is Iranian's first art, and the only thing that has Persian language as a minority language so far is the prevalence, influence, and potency of Persian poetry. Through the history, our country has been Persian poetry. The history of our country has been involved and attacked by many races, from Arabs to Mongolians and some other countries from this region, like Egypt, have lost their whole language to Arab. But Persian language has never perished, and it's meant be true to claim that 90% of Iranians still.
Do people still follow poetry in Iran? What's the situation there? Because I realize that nowadays it's almost like we live in the dark ages. For the arts, it's not very easy. And I'm wondering, especially for poetry, is it difficult?
Yes, yes, it's very difficult. You're absolutely right. And because of the censorship, the situation is getting worse.
So, like you said earlier, this film is very much autobiographical. You know, this is also about your very real frustrations and your lives in general.
Yes, sure. We are in the situation that we don't have any bright horizon in front of us. Future is very dark in our vision because of the many problems we're dealing with in these days. Such problems politically and socially and economically. When we were writing the screenplay about 2 years ago, so suddenly our economy collapsed and there was a very hard situation for people and us. So yes, the district terminal has come from a great depression and frustration, and it's going on, and there is a day by day the situation is getting worse. So we just in the district terminal, we just depict this frustration, but we are not hopeless. In the quotation that we brought from Ariel Dorfman in the beginning of the movie, Dorfman says that the dictators cannot continue their ruling because their people is growing a hope in their hearts. So maybe District Terminal looks like a very bitter movie and very frustrated, but the sales of the movie is shaped from a hope that maybe the situation is going to change. We don't know when.
Maybe it's not just about Iran and Middle East. Whole world is in dangerous nature, and the people. It's about a world.
We'll be right back for more on District Terminal in a moment.
Fred.
And we are back with Ehsan Mirhosseini and Bardia Yadagari, directors, screenwriters, actors and producers of the film District Terminal from Iran. And guys, I understand that you started writing and shooting the film well before the pandemic, but also because of the environmental themes that you tackle. Do you feel that District Terminal has since then acquired new meanings?
Yes, yes. All the process of screenplay and shooting was just before the pandemic, yeah. But because of the environmental disasters and phenomena such as global warming and drought and these things, we wanted to predict a future. So pandemic happened, and we ourselves got surprised because we didn't expect this happen very soon. We were showing the long future. But because of this situation that we have about environment and weather and global warming, so we cannot see any bright future for all of the world.
So would you guys consider yourselves environmentalists?
We are not activists, but Iran nature is beautiful and dangerous. And it's political in Iran, talking about nature.
Yeah.
Activists in jail, and I don't know why, but is a political.
In Iran, everything is political, especially environment issues. About 2 or 3 years ago, many of the environment activists got in jail. So talking about these matters is very political in Iran. And so there is a plan that Ramin, the other character in the movie, he died in the, we have a heli shot plan. So we almost get captured by the forces of government. Yeah. Is what very dangerous. It's very dangerous talking about these matters. We don't know why it's political, but it is.
But wait a minute. So what about this film, though? Because do you see this as a political film? And are you worried that the reactions that it might evoke, you know, some people may react to it unfavorably simply because of some of the things that you say in this film?
Yes, of course. But making movie is just solution for us, for continue life, for talking about our life. And we don't know how they react. Yes.
Yes. So there are some worries about the reaction. Yeah. We just wanted to talk about the truth, and maybe there will be some reactions. Yeah, we don't know yet, but we're expecting it.
Maybe next year we will talk with you in jail.
Oh man, I hope not. I hope not. But yeah, you're right. You know, sometimes art, that's the role of art, really, to talk about these things, right? At the end of the day.
Yes, you're right.
Okay. Also, we talked about the beauty of Persian poetry, but another thing that I noticed, especially in the character that you play, Bardia, is that it reminded me of the 40s beat writers. You know, that legendary sort of figures that would write poetry, listen to jazz, and take drugs. Yeah. There's a whole romantic sort of energy to that. Was that whole sort of time period also an influence in making this film?
Drug is my experience. Unfortunately, I took drug for 20 years. I don't lie about this. It's not good, but it's fact. And it's part of my character. Drugs in Iran is free. The drink and dance and everything is banned, but drug is available everywhere. Unfortunately, right. And we want to talk about us very honestly, and the drugs affair is part of my character.
Why did you start taking drugs, though?
I don't know why. Maybe I growing up in war in childhood and in fair. War. My friends in teenage age is very bad. And my neighborhood is full of drug. And maybe it's censorship. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, it's different things that sort of led you to take it. It was sort of an escape from both the drags of the trauma that you experienced and also the censorship that you experienced in struggling to be published. Everything comes together and then eventually you just resort to drugs. But I was referring earlier to the beat writers of the 40s in America, you know, Ginsberg and Kerouac.
Yeah.
They took drugs, and they drugs was a source of inspiration for them too. Were drugs a source of inspiration for you?
Yes, maybe drug is like a reaction to the defective and dominate system, which wants to interfere with all aspects of lives and works and supervise them. Humans can choose a gradual death, and the some sensitive ones feeling and more complicated his, her situation are.
Are you guys disappointed that right now, at least, the film will only be able to be screened online?
Yeah, so, but we are unhappy, but there is no choice because it's for everyone. We hope that the situation is getting better and we can show the movie on June with and see the movie with
audiences.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt. It was very great to talk to you. Thank you.
Your voice for your, full of energy.
For your attention.
And to be honest with you, I also found this film different from the typical film that I see coming out of Iran that make the film festivals. This is, it felt different from a lot of the films that I watch from Iran. And that's great because it means that, you guys are definitely trying something new, which is always good to see.
Thank you.
To hear that. We tried that because, you watch Iranian movies, most of them are such a melodramatic and socially movies. Because we are cinephiles, we try to use the history of cinema to make and to shape a fresh vision for our movies. Maybe this is the reason that you're talking about our movie as a different movie from other Iranian movie.
Okay, guys. So thank you very much once again, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you, Mr. Matt.
Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio was once again media partners of the Berlinale Talents, which, for those who do not know, is the Berlin International Film Festival's talent development program that explores the how and why of movie making. Chiara Nicoletti recorded an interview with its program manager, Florian Weghorn, and here is a clip of that interview.
So, first of all, how was this year? I mean, how did you experience this year in terms of, the planning of these talents?
Yeah, a very interesting time, of course, but I don't tell you something super surprising, I guess, because the least we can say in these times is that they are interesting. So, yeah. Of course, they have also been very challenging in many, many different ways, and I think that's also very clear to everyone here listening. But for the Berlinale, and in particular for Berlinale Talents, it was never a doubt that we need to come back, that we need to stay, and that we need to adjust ourselves. And in a way, I would say Berlinale Talents as kind of a speedboat within that big Berlinale structure has the advantage of being very flexible. So we have to reinvent ourselves every year anyway. So because, as you said, so being part of that collective of filmmakers raising different kind of questions and needs every year, we always look into what is needed, what is asked for, and what is offered, of course, from the film industry, and adjust our programs accordingly. This year, we changed a lot, so even a bit more than in other years, but I wouldn't say that Berlinale Talents is totally different to other years before. It's just on time.
Yeah, that leads me to the question that I always ask, but I'm particularly interested that this year, it is the theme of this year's edition, which is dreams. So why dreams, and how are you going to develop that?
Oh, because we love to dream.
Yeah.
And also, of course, we know and found out that dreaming per se as a process of digesting, processing, dreaming on, envisioning ideas is something which is not unlike to the film world itself, or to the way how we watch films, even in the cinema. So the Dream Factory cinema and everything around that well-known term, that is, of course, a good starting point to make and a good reason to make Berlinale Talents topic 2021 Dreams. But coming back a little bit also to the situation in which we are, of course, we've been asked, what can we do in this particular time? What is and how can we further on think about the future if you sometimes even don't know what the what tomorrow will look like. So it has become a bit complicated to envision your future every now and then. We'll do it, but it also comes with fears, with worries, sometimes hopes, hopefully. But with the dreams, it's a bit different. So because within that given framework of a dream, everything starts with what you are and what you've experienced. You can only dream about something that you've experienced somehow, but what you dream about is always new. So because it's reconnected, it's reframed, it's repositioned in a way on all time and spatial matters. So you're totally free within that given framework. And we thought that is a good way, a good metaphor also, of course, to work on in this particular year. The shelf, the framework is giving you safeness. So you can dream in this, and within that world, you can be totally free. And I think that is also something that makes our next week and also the dream on, so what's happened afterwards, a very, very fruitful process for the talents. But one last word about it. So dreaming is about bending time and space and thinking about how Berlinale Talents looks like this year with both the audience, the public audience, and of course the talents spread over all countries around the world, through all the different time zones, 65 different countries in the talents group alone. Wow. So we need to dream a lot so that we connect there.
Yeah, but I like the idea that all this situation that we're going through could be used also as an occasion, let's say, to experience new things, you know, new ways of reaching people or reaching filmmakers, but not only, also the audience. I mean, like, in a way, this virtual way of stay connected of the Berlinale Talents could be something that could be experienced in the future, even when we hopefully we'll go back to do everything physically in presence. I mean,
certainly. So we know that during the process of preparing Berlinale Talents, the question we raised to ourselves and to the talents and to our experts and to everyone was always, what's the essence of an event that we've made so far? So because creating a gathering, creating a talk, creating a party even, it's not necessarily because you want to make a party. It's because there is some deeper meaning behind that. And we took that essence, we found that essence, and we said, okay, it's actually to create a connection which is personal, or it is to exchange and change your perspective or something. And then we gave that, then we defined something like a new framework or a new bottle for that essence around, which is working in these times. But very soon, and also I would stress that, so Berlinale Talents doesn't go online or doesn't go virtual or something like that. It goes everywhere. So it, that means we have never been in so many places at one at the same time. So I don't want to turn everything into an advantage, because meeting and having everyone here in Berlin has, of course, been the best we are always hoping for. But now that the situation is like this, in terms of cultural exchange, in terms of changing your perspective, in terms of crossing barriers and borders, all these kind of convictions Berlinale Talents is working with, yeah, it's fine. We are everywhere. So, and this also goes to many, many of the events. So the people will bring in more of their worlds than a virtual background in Zoom.
To listen to the full interview, check out fred.fm/UK. That's fred.fm/UK.
Fred Film Radio.
Joining us at this time from Israel, filmmaker Hadas Ben-Haroya, director of All Eyes Off Me from the Panorama section of the Berlinale 2021. This is her second feature film, so I'm happy to get to talk about it with her. Hadas, welcome to the show.
Hello, hi, nice to meet
you. Great, so we're going to be talking about All Eyes Off Me, which is being screened or presented at the Berlinale this year. And just to introduce it a bit, would you maybe care to say a few words about maybe what the story is for the people who are not familiar with the film yet?
Yeah, of course. So the film, as you said, called All Eyes Off Me, and it's three episodes. The first one is with Danny, a young girl looking for Max, a guy who got her pregnant, and she wants to tell him she got pregnant by him. But then we find out that in the second episode that Max already have a new girlfriend, but then his new girlfriend already have someone else's in mind and starting a new relationship with someone else. So it's kind of three episodes in which everybody is starting a new relationship after the other is ending, sort of.
It's an exploration of love, sexual fantasies, intimacies, all of that, via the lives of particularly three different characters, like you said. But would it be right in saying that you were also interested in looking for new ways to explore intimacy, sexual fantasies, and love in cinema? One that maybe would represent modern life in a different and perhaps more legitimate way than what we normally see.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the thing that fascinates me the most is what is intimacy in our age, how intimacy shifted itself through time. And because we're very much liberated and everything is allowed and genders and, you know, participants in sex and, you know, so on. So everything is out there and you can experience everything. It has a toll, and the price of it is that you don't always know how you really feel, and like intimacy has become different. And so the heroine of the story finds herself trying to get hurt during sex, but what she really wants is to feel something, and it becomes very dangerous. So at the end she kind of finds out that the best way, and like this is my opinion as well, that the best way to feel intimacy is not by going very, very extreme. It's just going back to simplicity and being vulnerable in front of someone. If you're vulnerable in front of someone, this is what intimacy is, and this is the most powerful tool to feel, and not to go so radical.
Right. So, I mean, just to understand it more, do you feel that the generation of the contemporary world, at least the one that you explore, is more free, especially in terms of how it experiences love and sexuality?
I would say, yeah, but again, it's, you know, we're very, very free from the outside, but we are very scared. I mean, like, it will be super hard for us to say I love you or be vulnerable in front of someone, but it will be very easy for us to do very, you know, things that maybe our parents wouldn't have done. So everything is very, very much free, but between us, between like in terms of being vulnerable and like being very honest and authentic between one another, this is the scary thing. Like in the basic, we're not free, but from the outside we are. Like, we are always exposing ourselves on social media, and we are, I don't know, going to sex clubs, or, you know, we do a lot of things which you might call free, but at the core, we are very, very much afraid of being vulnerable.
So in this film, you, like you said, you explore sexual fantasies, particularly but not exclusively in Abhishek, wanting to feel pain during sex. But do you feel, and I guess you do, given what you have said in your previous answers, but I'd like to know more about it. Do you feel that sexual fantasies do play an important role in shaping society and in society at large?
Not exactly. I mean, I don't think it takes a big role, but like in the film, I try to do two things about the sexual fantasy. First is showing that, you know, that it's not about a BDSM experience with people who wear leather pants, and, you know, it's not, it's about trying, and like young people who are in love also try it, and it'd be a really nice, normal thing. But the other thing that I was trying to do is to show how dangerous it is, because, I mean, during this sexual fantasy, the rough sex that they are having, it's kind of a game. So inside the borders of the game, you can't really know how you feel, because you don't know if you are acting or you really feel that. I mean, if she is in pain and she's, I don't know, crying, is this part of the game, or does she really feel pain? You know what I mean? So it's super confusing because it is a game. And I think that in cinema, it's really interesting to show that on screen, because you as a spectator don't really know if that's part of the game or not. And also she doesn't feel that. And so there is also the moral question, because she asked her boyfriend to do that to her. She asked him, hit me and pull my hair and spit on me and so on. And then he does that, but he really hurts her. And that's there is a point where you don't know exactly if she's enjoying it or not. So this is super dangerous for people that are not really, you know, that don't do that for the right reasons, I would say. But it's super interesting in a cinematic way also, because you are also not sure what to feel.
Yes. And in fact, while we're on the topic, there would have been nothing worse in a film that explores sexuality and sex than having sex scenes that felt fake or constructed, which is something that I feel often happens, but not in your film. So how is it that the sex scenes of this film between Avishag and Max feel so legitimate in All Eyes Off Me?
Well, I was lucky enough to cast a couple, so that was an easy task to make them have sex.
Oh, right.
I mean, at first, Alisheva Weil, who plays Avishag, she's a really amazing actor. And she was the first one I casted. And then we together looked for the guy. And she pointed him, and she thought Lev Levine would be a good choice. And then when we chose, like, we casted him, afterwards they became a couple. Like, during casting or during, like, the rehearsal, they became a couple. So that was very, very easy, because they were very much in love. And, you know, we became super close friends. So, and we became very good friends with the DOP as well. So the whole atmosphere was very, you know, as easy as possible. Of course, it was hard, but it was, I felt like, you know, I'm not pushing anyone to do anything, because they, you know, they did it a lot after the shooting as well. So that was okay.
That's great. And I'm happy to hear they continue to do it after the shoot as well. But we're going to take a short break right now. And when we return, we'll be talking more about All Eyes Off Me from the 2021 Berlinale. So stay tuned.
Fred.
We are back with filmmaker Hadas Ben-Haroya, director of All Eyes Off Me, a film that explores intimacy, sexual fantasies and love in modern times. In this part, we're going to focus on style a bit more. And this may seem like a simple question, but I was curious. What is the meaning of the title, All Eyes Off Me?
Okay, so the meaning of the film is, you know, first of all, like, when you, even though it's not gender, you don't know what's the gender of it, because it's All Eyes Off Me, you still feel it's a woman. I don't know. I felt it have to be a woman. So I found it interesting. And also, so we kind of follow Avishag's story, but we see her from other perspective. We see other eyes that's telling her story. And so that's part of the thing. And also the feeling that you are very much disconnected from, you know, not being able to communicate or not being able to fully realize what you feel. So that there is like this feeling that is represented by the title. So I don't know, it just felt right, you know.
Yeah, I'll get back to that later, actually, because you introduced something that's quite interesting. But speaking of the structure of the film, splitting the film into three parts, I mean, I guess you mentioned the thing about the perspective on Avishag, mm-hmm. but also, is there something about this particular structure that you find stimulating in other ways as a storyteller?
Yeah, I liked it really much, because I felt like, first of all, I felt that we kind of starting with the main character, who's Danny, and we kind of kill her after the first part. It's like you're very much connected to a character, but then you don't see her anymore. I felt like it's like in Games of Thrones when you kill the main character and you're like, no. So it's stupid, but this is why I felt like it would be very interesting to go with some character and then not seeing her anymore. But also I felt like it's a really nice journey to take, as you know, in a narrative perspective, that you have a protagonist, but you see her through other eyes, and you see different conflicts of different protagonists that tells their story, but actually tells her story. So you kind of see a panoramic view of her generation, of her world, that tells her story, but through other people's story. So it looks like an ensemble story, but it's actually hers. So you always like have to think through while you're watching the film. You have to think all the time. You have to be active and not just lay back. And you really need to like to join the dots. And I think it's more engaging that way.
You know, a term that I was thinking about as well while I was watching your film was groove, which is sort of a term that's obviously used in music more than films. But it's true, because there's a real construction of space and atmosphere in your film. And I noticed that you tend to use dialogue sparingly, is what I'm trying to say. And you opt instead for, you know, silences, music or sound. Is there a reason for this?
I don't know. Like, I really like dialogue. It's like a tool that I really like using. So, you know, the film is, you know, you have a lot of stories. People are telling their stories a lot through the film. And I use dialogue as a tool to understand the characters. I use a lot of, I don't know, repetitive kind of dialogue, but I also use a lot of silence and music. And I basically, I don't know, like I'm trying to fill the film with things that I like. So if there is a song I like, I would just put it there. And if there is someone told me something, I will put it there. I don't know. I like this veggie hot dogs. So everybody in my films eats veggie hot dogs, and I'm just putting like things in the film that I like and kind of combined.
Veggie hot dogs.
Yes.
There's a song called Veggie Hot Dogs.
No, it's not a song. It's just veggie hot dogs.
Oh, right. No, I should know about those. I'm a vegetarian, so I I'm all about those. Hey.
Yeah.
Let's give a shout out to Veggie Hot Dogs.
Woo! No, they're doing it really well here in Israel. They have really good veggie hot dogs. So all the people in my film are eating veggie hot dogs.
Awesome.
No, I was trying to say that I'm like I'm just doing the film for me to be happy. So I'm watching the film and I'm like showing myself things that I like. So I'll put a song that I like. I'll put a reality TV show that I like, and I will put dialogue that I like. Eventually, it's me bringing
it's all
presents
part of it
to myself. Yeah.
Does filmmaking make you happy?
Of course.
You know, we talked about it earlier, so this is something that I wanted to go back to. And I feel that your film, we've talked about perspective and, you know, also desire, I guess, in a way. And pretty much since the birth of theory of film, scholars have talked about the relationship between cinema and desire. And this has often been identified as a male-dominated desire. Do you think that this is changing, perhaps also thanks to films like yours, where this concept of desire, also in relation to love and sex, is much more fluid? It's becoming much more fluid?
This is a really good question, because I'm so confused, to be honest. Like, yesterday I saw, this is have nothing to do with our conversation in a way, but I have to say that. Yesterday I saw the second episode of the Ellen versus Pharaoh. Have you seen that?
No, I have not.
Okay, so that really made me think, because I love Woody Allen, and he writes like in Manhattan, let's say, about a relationship between a 17 years old girl. And I always thought that legitimate to show through art what you feel, and art can show everything. You can show, I don't know, a pedophile point of view because it's art. But then it made me think a lot, and this comes to your question now, because I feel that maybe all of us got really structured to think some things in our brain. Like, after I saw that, I Googled, why does young women love older men? And so I saw a lot of, you know, articles about it, but really weird articles. Like, let's say it was like 10 reasons, and like, one, because they're successful, two, because they have money, three, because they give you security. And I was like, no, I can't believe it. And then I was like, okay, like, I know that, but now I see that the media gave us like certain way of thinking things, and maybe my thoughts are not my thoughts. Maybe my thoughts are what I grew up seeing in media. And what I'm trying to say, that without even like trying to, if I'm bringing my voice, like my female gaze, my female voice to the world, it's super important. And it's very, very much important to, you know, to break this structure that we were all based on without even knowing.
Thank you very much. So I remind our listeners that the film is called All Eyes Off Me. And thanks a lot. And obviously, you know, it is a shame that you can't be in Berlin right now. But you're fingers crossed that later on this year, when the Berlinale will do its second run, you'll be able to travel, right?
Yeah, I would love that. Yes, I really hope that will take place.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks you for having me. It was a pleasure. Bye.
Fred Film Radio.
Cinephile, we are smack in the middle of this Berlinale-tastic episode of the Big Fred Tuesday, and it's time to talk about some of the winners of this year's edition. The coveted Golden Bear for Best Film went to Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn, the improbably titled new film by Romanian director Radu Jude. I watched it. I thought it was okay. The film is described as a scathing social satire about sex, lies and videotape. And it was shot entirely during the COVID lockdown last summer, with cast and crew all wearing antiviral masks. It divided critics and has been called a typically left-field decision from Berlin. But again, I watched it and I thought it was okay. The Silver Bear for Best Director went to Denis Nagy for Natural Light, which follows Hungarian soldiers in World War II as they patrol the icy forests of Ukraine on the hunt for Soviet partisans. A special jury award went to German documentarian Maria Speth for Herr Bachmann and His Class, a fly-on-the-wall documentary that follows a German teacher in his final year with a class of mainly immigrant and ethnic minority children. The runner-up grand jury prize was awarded to Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy, a female-driven ensemble drama from Japanese director Ryusuke Hamaguchi. For the first time this year, Berlin did not gender its acting awards, handing out just one Silver Bear for Best Leading Performance, which went to Maren Eggert for her starring role in Maria Schrader's sci-fi screwball comedy I'm Your Man. In the encounter section, meant to highlight films that aim to foster aesthetically and structurally daring works from independent, innovative filmmakers, the top prize for Best Film went to We by Alice Diop. More winners were announced, but I don't want to bore your pants off carrying on listing them. Just want to wrap it up by saying that due to the coronavirus pandemic, this year's Berlin Festival has been split into two events. An online-only event with the accompanying European Film Market was held this week, from the 1st of March to the 5th of March, primarily for the international industry and press. A second public festival is planned in Berlin from the 9th to the 20th of June, so keep an eye on that one. I'd like to also congratulate all the winners, although as usual, I encourage you, cinephile, not to just look at the films that win the awards, but embrace any viewing opportunity to watch anything at any time that you may come across. But you, being a cinephile and listening to this, probably already know that, because you're probably as obsessed as me. After all, life without awe is flatline, as Henry Rollins says. We'll be right back with the Big Fred Tuesday after this.
Fred.
Cinephile, you're listening to The Big Fred Tuesday, the weekly online radio show on all things cinema. And joining us at this time is Gustavo Pizzi, who is the director of a miniseries named The Last Days of Gilda from Brazil. It's based on a theatre monologue slash play, but definitely resonates with today's world because it's the story that revolves around a free and independent woman living in a neighbourhood on the edge of the favela and the increasing hostilities between her and the reactionary Christians gaining the upper hand on the territory. This is just a brief synopsis. And of course, The Last Days of Gilda has been presented at the Berlinale in its Berlinale series section. Very happy to be talking about it. Gustavo, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure, Matt. Nice to meet you.
I wanted to start off by sort of asking you a very simple question. You probably answered this a lot over whatever number of interviews you've done so far, but how much of this series is inspired by the current socio-political situation of Brazil?
Yeah, I think that we are always thinking about the time we are living. This is about the original play was wrote in 2003, for example. And of course, we brought a lot of things from the original monologue. It was something like some phrases, some small parts. They became bigger parts for the script. So we, of course, after 2016, we were really thinking about the political situation in our country. And around the world too. So we brought a lot from what was happening in the world and in our neighborhoods too, and in our country. The political situation is really, it's almost just like that when you see.
Yeah, especially for the arts, it must be very difficult right now, right?
Yeah, because when we shot the series between the two rounds of the presidential election in Brazil in 2018. We were in a really strange moment as many places of the world. But at the beginning, we didn't believe that Bolsonaro would win the election, would go to the second round. And then when we start shooting, we were there with Bolsonaro and Haddad, the guy from the left wing, and we were starting to realize that he could win. And we were anxious about what could happen to our industry, what could happen to our lives, because it was already, we could already understand where we could be in a few time.
Right.
And yes, it was now after he came he was elected, and we saw that it was really, really terrible for all of us. We used to have 300,000 people employed by the Brazilian industry of cinema. And nowadays, of course, we have the pandemic, but even before it was devastated.
Yeah, I heard some terrible things about the Cinemateca Brasileira as well, which is very sad. But that makes all the series, a series such as yourself, your own one, all the more significant. And I'm also thinking, do you think that it's particularly significant that the protagonist of The Last Days of Gilda is a woman, a free and independent woman?
Yeah, she's there trying to live her life as the way she believes it's right. She's not doing nothing bad to anyone. But people around her, they believe that they can stop her to doing what she believes. And it's something that we were facing in Brazil, because in doing films or things that we used to believe, we started to have a persecution against artists, against some parts of the society. And it's been hard for her, as for everyone we were talking about.
But in terms of her actually being a female character, the perception throughout history has always been that free and independent women are a real threat against the social norm, so to speak. So I wondered whether that mm-hmm. also came into play when you were working on the series, the significance of that.
Yes. It's really important. When I saw for the first time the original play on the stage, I was there, it was 2004. And at that time, it was already something really significant, even more than we think nowadays. At that moment, when we start to work for the first ideas of a script, it was something really, really important to us already. And from those last years, all the conquerors that the feminist movement were getting, it became even more significant to understand, to try to bring these discussions to her body, to her way of being there. She doesn't need to say nothing like a statement. She is the statement.
We'll be right back for more on the last days of Gilda from the Berlinale series strand of the Berlinale 2021 in a moment.
Red Film Radio.
We are back with Gustavo Pizzi joining us from Brazil, and we have been speaking about his series, The Last Days of Gilda, which has been presented at the Berlinale series strand of the Berlinale 2021. And Gustavo, we've been talking a lot about freedom and independence, which are two of the pivotal themes explored in this series. So before we continue to dissect the series and talk about its style a bit, I wanted to ask you, as a side note, I'm curious, do you have a personal definition for freedom?
Well, that's a tough question. I believe that freedom is that's something that you make what you believe, the way that you believe. If you're not doing something wrong, or if you're doing something that nothing against anyone, and you have the chance to live your life the way that you can make the best for your life, maybe
it's a difficult concept to kind of define.
It's amazing,
really, especially in
some, it's amazing to bring this, because you come out of the regular questions and make my brain works differently. Congratulations for the question.
Well, no, because I realized that while I was watching the series too, I felt that I sensed a timelessness to it that also makes me think about the repetition of time and how some things just history repeats itself. And I wondered whether that was intentional. Did you want that, or was that just me, the sense of timelessness?
Yeah, I think that it's something that always happened, what happened to Gilda. If she lived in the Middle Ages, for example, she would be persecuted and maybe treated as a witch, for example, and maybe burned, you know. If she lived in the 60s in Brazil, on the moment of the dictatorship government, Brazilian government, at that moment she would be arrested and killed for the government also. And nowadays we have this different challenge that we are facing in our society, and we have to understand how to deal with this challenge of this time, specific time. But it's always really hard to see what's happening when you were living on that moment. So that's something that when we make a film or write a book, or, you know, you have ways to think about your time, they are really important to bring more attention for some points and help the general discussion around the society.
Right. Yeah. And speaking of art. We've talked about the importance of art. And another thing that I noticed while I was watching the series is that there's so many influences and so much style. I mean, the style of the film is very eclectic to me. It felt like there was many elements and influences coming from different places. Again, we go back to this sense of timelessness that I spoke of. But would you define yourself as the sort of filmmaker who likes to take different influences from different visual arts and different artworks and different films too? I noticed maybe this was just me again, little Johnny Guitar Western influence here or there. But yeah, do you like to do that?
Yeah, I think that each project is a different project. It's kind of relearn everything again. And of course, you have a lot of things that you use it to watch and study, and it's all, everything is there. All the reference that you have as a student or as an artist, there with you. And when you are working something new, you're trying to discover that universe. It's something that the moment that you're going to use, even if it's not something that we're thinking about specifically about that, but it came. And of course, you have your beauty and universe. And when you are beauty and universe, you have to understand the rules of that universe to make sense with the whole thing you have around. And I believe I always like to have everything I can have at that specific moment, and bring those references and absorb the reference and translate in another different things from a mix that through me and through my collaborators, and we think about that new universe that we're trying to bring.
I think we're just about to have to wrap it up, so probably just time for one last question. Unfortunately, but time is cruel, you know, that's how yes. It is though. But I definitely want to ask you this, and again, this may be a simple question, but you've worked on feature films before. This is a series. Is there something about the structure of this series that you find stimulating in different ways from that of the traditional feature film length or structure?
That's a good point, because I'm always doing what I learned to do and what I love to do. I'm always thinking about cinema. I'm not thinking about a TV or something like that. Even before, when the lines were more defined, you know, TV and cinema, I believe that nowadays we don't have this kind of difference. We don't need those then anymore. Before, we used it to have TV shows, I don't know, 3 seasons, 4, 5, 7 seasons. Each week you have a new episode, because the TVs, they needed that. They must have to, they had to put on their, how can I say, the space they need, you know, it must be Tuesday, 3 o'clock. You must have a new episode. Nowadays, it's different. We have a new way for distribution. Of course, we still have the TVs. But if you don't need to have a new episode that day at that moment, you can watch everything at the same time. You can imagine other possibilities. So a limited series, it's a short limited series, for example. I believe that's a place where creators and their cinema directors, or only people from the original, from TV also, we can find a really special place to build really interesting universes. Limited series can be a really good product as well too.
Yeah. Gustavo, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for doing this. I appreciate it. Best of luck.
Thank you. Me too.
Fred Film Radio.
While we're on the topic of series, why not take a break from the Berlinale and listen to a clip of Chiara Nicoletti's recent interview with Jess Hall, director of photography of the Disney Plus miniseries WandaVision, which has been all the rave with my nostalgia babies as of late. I am told one of the things that makes this series so acclaimed is exactly that. It's visual, striking beauty. So here's a clip of that interview.
I was curious. I was reading the production notes, and it said that you use 47 lenses to create 7 different periods. So, but I was curious to understand, how did you find the balance between, you know, the typical elements of the 7 different periods and the references to TV and sitcoms from those periods?
There's a lot of answers to that. I mean, I think the lenses, to start with that, yeah, it was 47. I actually was counting them yesterday. It might have even been a couple more. But, you know, I knew that I couldn't, with the lenses, have like a different set for every period, because then it would have been like 147. So I had to kind of, in a way, group them into 3 different groups. So I tried to find some commonality between like the 50s to the 70s and use one set for that. And then some commonality between the, you know, 80s to 2000s and then another set for that. And then, you know, really moving into the MCU kind of, the modern look, I went to the, lenses that were used for, Avengers Infinity War and Endgame. So there was basically 3 sets of lenses spread across 7 looks. So they each had to accommodate, you know, a couple. And that was just a practical, you know, practical decision, really. But then the second part of the question is more about building the reference in relation to what we actually photographed, which, you know, it was, I would describe it as a very detailed analysis of original material mixed with a kind of, my own, you know, our own aesthetic kind of sensibility and what we thought was appropriate for the narrative. So we did kind of really analyze a lot of the original shows very carefully, looking at, you know, not only the kind of camera work, but also the lighting and the, you know, the editing style, the performance style, everything. And that was broken down into a bunch of different kind of, you know, documents, and also, you know, reading books, you know, historical books about how they actually shot these shows. And also drawing on the director's experience, because Matt Shackman was actually a child actor in sitcoms. So he had first-hand experience of how these shows were shot. So he did a thing called Sitcom Boot Camp, where he kind of taught us all the language of sitcoms, you know, because we weren't all so familiar with that. You know, I come more from a feature background. So it was a big learning curve. And, you know, looking at the original shows, the history of them, looking at archive shots of how the sets were kind of built and constructed and lit, all of that really, and all just fed into this kind of melee of, you know, part original, part kind of, you know, our own thing. So we'll create something new out of that, really.
You were talking about the books and the research you did to dive into these time periods, but what was the most surprising thing for you, and which of the time periods was the hardest one for you to reproduce?
I think the hardest ones for me were the earlier episodes. I think particularly sort of 1, 2, and 3, because they were shot on film. You know, and the whole workflow for the kind of platform of Disney Plus is extremely high level. Like, we're working in 4K HDR, which is actually a higher level mastering than the movies did. You know, they actually did a conversion to HDR normally as their workflow, but part of our original workflow was, you know, lighting and shooting for 4K HDR. So we're starting with this incredibly sophisticated end product as our target, but then we're kind of replicating this incredibly degraded, you know, soft film look. And so it's kind of mashing these two technologies together was a real challenge. And it had to sort of, you know, it was multiple levels that had to work on. You know, it was a combination of, you know, set design, lighting, you know, lensing, color science within the camera, all these different things that I had to do to achieve that. And I think that did make the first 3 episodes harder. Because once you sort of moved into kind of video, at least just sort of starting with a digital platform, there's sort of more commonality there. But I'd say the hardest episode for me was episode 3, because it's early color film. And when I looked at the reference for that, you know, it's just so specific, like what's happening with the emulsion, with the photochemical process, with that early color work. You get these kind of really specific color tones. You get kind of a very specific palette. You get this kind of cross bleed of, you know, the photochemical process, you know, with colors seeping into one another. And it was really a very difficult look to emulate digitally. And there was a lot of work that was done there where I kind of took original stills from the period and I analyzed the color values, the RGB values, and then I built a kind of 20 color palette out of those RGB values and shared those across the art department and the wardrobe. So we could actually like really isolate the colors in every department and kind of replicate this color palette. And then kind of trying to replicate the lighting. I used period lighting fixtures as much as possible. But still I had to kind of add lighting gels to the period lights to kind of make them, you know, look right and to get the color balance of these kind of strange peachy kind of technicolor skin tones. And, you know, and then we talked about the lensing a little bit with Kiara, but, you know, we custom made lenses for that, for the series one set of lenses, which do episode 1, 2, and 3 were, you know, were a new lens assembly that were kind of custom designed to have these specific period characteristics of, you know, softness and the halation and the highlights, and all of that. So yeah, it was a pretty involved process, especially for those first three episodes.
To listen to the full interview, check out fred.fm/UK. That's fred.fm/UK.
Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio.
Cinephile, I hope you enjoyed this one. I certainly did. And now for the icing on the cake, our conclusive popcorn classic segment. We've been receiving a lot of faxes about this one, which was amazing because we didn't even know that we had a fax machine. But we've been getting very enthusiastic responses about this segment. This is, of course, the segment where I highlight an alternative cinema title which may help you further your explorations in the wonderful world of cinema and eventually earn you a black belt in true cinephilia. But this week I decided to choose a title that is maybe the best known one of the ones I have picked for this segment so far. I'm talking about Austrian filmmaker Michael Haneke's The White Ribbon from 2007, one of his most famous and acclaimed movies for sure. It's kind of a choral movie that takes place in a rural Austrian village just before the beginning of the First World War, which becomes the setting of a series of violent events that shake up the balance of the life in said village. This is really a great one. Shot in beautiful black and white cinematography, the style is very still and confident and sets this tone of slow burning yet intense mystery. It's also a profound exploration of the patriarchal social structure and challenges it, as well as other things like the innocence with which children are often portrayed, the sacrality of the wedding vows, and so on. It's definitely an intense and gripping watch, which means that even though The White Ribbon exceeds the 2 hours in length, you don't necessarily feel it, and you'll be compelled to watch it until the end. Again, I suspect many of you listening to this will be familiar with The White Ribbon by Michael Haneke, the great Austrian filmmaker. If you're not familiar with his works at all, that's okay. Either this or Amour from 2012 is a good place to start as far as his filmography is concerned. I will give this one five bags of popcorn, five cups of soda, and a white ribbon. Frankly, because I can't think of anything else more creative right now. It's been a long week, but it's been a good week. Again, I hope you enjoyed our trip to Berlin, Germany for a special Berlinale-tastic episode of Online Radio's only weekly show on alternative cinema with a particular focus on independent filmmaking and the international film festival scene. Don't forget that you'll be able to find more interviews from the Berlinale across all of our channels. So till the next time, stay healthy, stay safe, stay strong, stay cinephile, and stay tuned to Fred Film Radio, the festival insider.
Fred Film Radio, this is Nicolo Comotti here at Venice Days.
Fred Film Radio, sono Chiara Nicoletti.
Angelo Acerbi per Fred Film Radio, on è al Festival di Venice.
Fred Film Radio, z vami sono Bor Pretersic.
Fred Film Radio, radio filmowe Fred, z tej strony Anna Tatarska.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Fred Film Radio,
24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.